People are working on complicated projects, many of which have never been done the exact same way before. And there's a lot of need for ongoing communication, coordination, experimentation. That calls for very open communication, a lot of honesty about especially what things aren't working well, which is nearly impossible to do, to be honest, to be candid when you have a toxic boss.
Hi, it's Terry McDougall, your host on Winning Game of Work. That quote is from one of my guests today, Dr. Amy C. Edmondson, who is a professor at Harvard Business School and also the author of numerous books, including the upcoming The Right Kind of Wrong, The Science of Failing Well. She is joining me once again with Dr. Tomas Chamora Pernuzic, who is a psychologist, entrepreneur, professor, and also author of the book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It? So this is the second half of our conversation, which we started on last week's episode. And this week, my partner on this special series, Lisa Edmondson, who is the founder of the Leadership Reform Movement, is also joining us. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Welcome to Winning the Game of Work, a podcast that helps you enjoy the happy and successful career you've dreamed of. Because let's face it, being hardworking and smart just aren't enough in today's competitive workplace. I'm your host, Terry McDougall, an experienced executive coach who will teach you all the right moves so you can win the game of work with ease and confidence. Welcome back, Dr. Amy, Dr. Tomas, and Lisa. So last time, Dr. Amy, we were talking about how critical good management is to creating the healthy and productive work environment. I would love for you to talk more about that.
Over time, it's hard to get away without good management because management is the art of getting the work done through others and helping develop them along the way so that they are less in need of micromanaging. That's the wrong word, but just explicit guidance on everything. You're developing their skills so that they can do what needs to be done and do it together. Tomas mentions teaming, which is exactly right. In most organizations today, the work is highly interdependent. We don't have just a bunch of people in the pin factory doing their little tasks and out the door it goes. People are working on complicated projects, many of which have never been done the exact same way before. And there's a lot of need for ongoing communication, coordination, experimentation, to kind of figure out what's working, what isn't working. That calls for very open communication, a lot of honesty about especially what things aren't working well, which is nearly impossible to do, to be honest, to be candid when you have a toxic boss.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dr. Tomas, would love to hear from you as well. What are your thoughts on this topic?
When you look at the MBA program, it has adapted or expanded in the last 10, 15 years to include more of this education on soft skills and the how and not just the what, and shifting from like expertise and knowledge to the actual softer, but really hardest parts of being a leader and being a manager. Has that been incorporated?
I think so. I think we'd have a hard time finding an MBA program that hasn't worked hard over the last few years to incorporate the interpersonal skills, leadership skills that are really about understanding, connecting with, working effectively with other human beings. And I think that started a while back as, oh, we got to teach people to work in teams because we're graduating all these individuals, high-powered, smart, they've learned their finance and their marketing content, but off they go and they don't know how to work together. So then it was a big push to more team projects, more team courses. Yep, did that. But I think we're now realizing more and more that it's not enough to put them in teams. There are real skills and mindsets that have to be taught and practiced to do teaming well.
Yeah, you know, I think that this is really interesting. And one of the things that I experienced a lot in the corporate world and what I've seen a lot with my clients is that there's a lot of pressure on executing, obviously, right? In business, we need to execute to be profitable. But I think that there's a foundation that needs to be laid underneath of that. And that starts with clear communication, with trusting relationships, and with alignment. And so often those things are ignored. And that really is where talented leadership exists, where people are taught to communicate clearly, or that that's valued within organizations, that people who are willing to be vulnerable and to speak truth and to look for that alignment so that more energy goes towards productive outcomes rather than conflict and friction and so forth.
It might be helpful to unpack execution. I think it's important to ask what portion of the work in a given team or any given organization is executable in a straightforward way, meaning there is a codified process, a recipe that says, just do this and you will get the outcome that we sorely need. Thankfully, the answer isn't zero, right? There's a fair amount of the work that is codified and we know it's about execute it to spec. But an awful lot and a growing portion of the work is just not about mere execution. It's about problem solving, creating judgment, testing, experimenting, and then coming up with something that might work here and now, but may not work there or tomorrow. So in many ways, I think the mindset of execution is part of the problem. The mindset that says, if you're a good employee and you work hard enough, you're going to get the quarterly results we want. Nonsense. We're going to get the quarterly results we want to a large degree based on effort, to a large degree based on luck, to a large degree based on creativity and connecting with customers where they are. So it's just not as straightforward as here's the plan, let's align, let's execute. And sometimes I think that very mindset is the sort of underlying cause of many of these challenges.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the future hasn't been written, you know?
Right.
So things that worked in the past aren't necessarily going to work going forward. And we do need people that are aware in the moment. And this addresses your book, right? To be willing to try things.
Be willing to try and to be humble enough to know that you don't have all the answers. You're not the boss in the old-fashioned sense of the boss, who was the boss because he was smarter, knew more, had more experience. I mean, more often than not, when you are a manager, you are managing people who have considerable expertise that you don't have. And you're the convener, the enabler. It's a very different mindset.
Yeah, and I think that makes the case for vulnerability, which Amy and I have written about. So it's a pretty rich and interesting concept. But I think on the one hand, it is a useful reminder that in a world where followers or employees are mature enough that they understand that in today's complex knowledge economy, it is absolutely impossible for a leader or boss to have all the answers, the capacity to say, I don't know, I made a mistake, I am worried about this. This is just realism. And it just really creates candid and open relationship between you and your boss that harnesses and fosters a lot of positive outcomes in the team, including all the ones Amy just described. On the other hand, to the extent that we can get more organizations to truly embrace the importance and the benefits of vulnerability in leadership, we will end up with fewer narcissists in charge.
Yeah, I was just thinking when you were saying that people that say, hey, I don't know the answer and sorry, I made a mistake or whatever. I was like, those are things that no narcissist ever said. Dr. Tomas, I have a question for you, and it's, why do so many incompetent men become leaders? Why is that? That's a very interesting title to your book.
Yeah, it's often described as a provocative title, which I guess it is, but the book is just an answer to that question. And I think the simple answer is that we are not very competent when it comes to understanding, identifying, and selecting leaders. Why? Because we focus much more on style than on substance. And why? Because as the landscape and nature of talent has increased substantially in complexity over the past century or so, our reaction is to become very lazy and to not make an effort to understand whether somebody has what it takes to lead, but just guide ourselves by our instincts. And in a world that is driven mostly by instincts, the capacity to be assertive and seem unaware of your limitations and to entertain and to overclaim and display overconfidence is sadly mistaken as competence. And that is significantly more common in men than in women. although women are catching up in most places, but it's still more common in men than in women. So if we focus more on talent, we would not just end up with more women in charge, we would also end up with slightly more women than men in charge, but fundamentally we would end up with better leaders, which is the short final chapter of the book, which I was forced to include by my publisher because they wanted a how to fix it. I'm always more interested in highlighting the problems than the solutions, but you know.
Can I just add one? I mean, it's just the most glaring and crazy one that you can add to that list of things that the lazy person, the lazy observer is looking to. Height. I mean, what exactly is the percentage of CEOs who are above 6 feet? And now let's compare that to the percentage of those in the population who are above 6 feet, and it's order of magnitude off, right? So we're using all the wrong cues to make our judgments about who's a good leader. And all those wrong cues, as you say, are overrepresented in the male half of the...
Exactly. And there is an aggravating factor, right? Which is that as the world becomes more complex, it's harder to realize whether we made a mistake or not. It's harder. In our predecessors, our ancestors in the Homo sapiens kind of realm, if you chose the wrong leader to manage or direct your hunter-gatherer group, you would just be eaten or killed by a predator. If, however, you appoint the wrong CEO and you fail to execute your digital transformation, maybe in 5 or 6 years it will become clear and then we can blame so many other people. And I mean, just look at Boris Johnson now. I mean, he resigned. Most people agree that he failed to lead his country. He's probably going to have a best-selling autobiography. And I understand that he's being considered as new Secretary General for the UN, you know?
Well, Dr. Amy, I think that that's fascinating about the height. And I was thinking earlier about the fact that how much of who we choose to be leaders is just based on what we're used to seeing. You know, we're used to seeing the guy who looks good in the Brooks Brothers suit. I worked in banking, so we're used to seeing the guy that's 6'2" in the pinstripe suit being the leader. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're good at it, but they look the part. They're coming from quote unquote central casting. And obviously, I think we need to change that. We need to start casting different people. And it's kind of nice to see that sometimes Hollywood now will put women as the president or whatever. But what else can we do to open the eyes of very senior leadership to start recognizing that talent can exist in any number of packages?
I think Tomas raised the issue, which is really the thorny part here, which is that its performance or outcomes are very noisy these days, right? Noisy, delayed. You have to be an extraordinarily good systems thinker to effectively draw a line between that lever of, let's say, the incompetent leader and a problematic result. So maybe part of the answer then is we've got to find ways to sort of shed more light on these effects. And maybe just a session like this is a small part of that. But it's about helping people understand that the, as you said, economic, but also psychological and other costs of where we started out, bullying, toxic leadership, are enormous. And once understood, it's like Tomas and I both have a preference for, or at least a skill set for sort of identifying the problem more than fixing the problem, because that's what researchers do. But our analyses do point us in the direction of at least where to focus some effort.
Yeah, I feel like if more organizations would invest in the leadership training and in the tools that they can use to train around interviewing and maybe bring in the experts to do the evaluations of people coming in for senior leader roles, that they'd get a return on that investment that would be well worth it. But I think that it's sort of like the one hand clapping, right? It's like, where's the evidence? They need to invest first. And then how do they know that they wouldn't have gotten that outcome without the investment? It's curious. And I'm just wondering, how can organizations be influenced?
Yeah, there is a lot of evidence right now. So there's a lot of external evidence. The scientific evidence is overwhelming, and it has been for the last 3 or 4 decades. So if anything, this is about the science and practice gap. I'm generally a pessimist, but I do think that things are improving. You know, there is significant external pressure today on even the most traditional corporations to seem more humble, more inclusive, and at least feel guilty if they're not trying to transform. But I think, Terry, to your point, I don't think the issue is absence in investing and training, but changing the status quo. And because the status quo has no desire to disrupt itself, and it's still made of the old guard, the real power is still concentrated there. I think it's Max Planck who said that in science, you don't persuade your critics, you just wait for them to die. And the same applies to leadership development. You don't develop new leaders, you wait for the old guard to go. And then all we can hope for is that the new guard doesn't become like the old guard when they get there, because I think there is a generational change. And the mindset certainly is different.
Lisa, I think you had something that you wanted to say.
Oh, I'm just chomping at the bit here. Violently agreeing. It's people like Dr. Amy and Dr. Tomas that the information they bring to the table gives us clear evidence of what we should be looking for. And so what I'm trying to do here is share that evidence and show how it flows through into hiring decisions and metrics that we measure our managers on and what to evaluate for to know if I'm a good people leader. So I think that's what we're trying to do here with this mission is implement this amazing information we have. We know what we need to do. We know what we need to look for. It's convincing the C-suite that this is the right thing to do. And I think that's why part of my solution includes incorporating some type of employee engagement survey just to get a baseline feed on, okay, where might be our problem areas? Because if it's conducted by a third party like Gallup, which we talked about the other day, it solicits information that is honest and truthful from the employees. And it's really actionable information that is obviously shared with management. So take action on that feedback and then hold those leaders accountable. Because in my mind, if I were a CEO and I saw that one of my leaders had low management scores, because that's, for example, one of the sections in the engagement survey, I would want to know why and what's going on. This is a problem. Let's do something about it. And quite frankly, if you have more than one person on a team who's saying my manager doesn't support me or I don't feel supported by my manager, whatever that survey question is, that's a pattern. And so I'm not saying you have to get rid of that leader, but you either need to conduct some type of remediation to retrain them or tell them these are the areas that are important, or this is how we prefer that our leaders interact with employees, or you rehome them, give them an individual contributor job and don't have them lead people. We're not saying you got to get rid of your smart people, but do they have to always be leading people? And so that's kind of a decision within each company. But I think one example of that, and I don't have clear evidence to prove this, but just my own personal observation is I think I've heard just looking at Microsoft, their most recent CEO, Satya, he seems to bring to the table that type of interest. He genuinely seems to place a lot of importance on people managers and how people interact with one another in the office place. So again, this is just from outsider looking in. I don't know if that can be confirmed or not, but I think if it is what I think it is, then you'll probably have already seen massive changes happen throughout that organization because it trickles down, but it has to come from the top, unfortunately, because if it's not supported at the top, then that means the bad behavior is condoned. So,
yeah. You know, the thing that was coming to mind as you were talking about that, Lisa, I agree with you. And at the same time, I was thinking the fox is in the hen house because so often the leaders who are getting those low engagement scores, they're in the meetings that are trying to solve the problem and they can spin it and they do spin it and they will pin the blame on people and so forth. But I also love the idea that a CEO at a very influential company like Microsoft, that if they're starting to embrace a different view of things, that can be very influential in the corporate environment because leaders look to certain leaders to say, hey, how are they doing things? Like, oh, that's a progressive company. We want to be doing things like Microsoft is doing or Google is doing or whatever. Dr. Amy and Dr. Tomas, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on how certain leaders within the corporate environment can influence other leaders to lead differently within their own organizations.
So I think this is it, right? I think is what both of you were just saying. And again, I think this is where perhaps there is room for a little bit of rational optimism because 100 years ago, no company asked their employees if they were happy, if they were engaged, if their manager treated them well, or if they were a psychopathic narcissist. 100 years ago, employees didn't have the power they have now. And 100 years ago, nobody would have thought that in public companies, investments and investors would make decisions based on how inclusive, diverse, or pro-social or not organizations are. And we are very, very quickly headed to a world where it's going to be increasingly difficult for companies to make fake claims or virtue signal without the evidence to back it up. So 100 years is nothing in the grand scheme of things. And by the way, 100 years ago, we didn't have a science and a body of knowledge or evidence to actually make this point in organizations that are trying to be more data-driven. And I agree about Satya and Microsoft, and I think it's good that he's getting a lot of kudos and recognition and publicity. But unfortunately, whatever Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and all of the other people do still attracts a lot more media attention. And there will be many more movies about them than Angela Merkel or Satya Nadella.
Thank you for at least confirming that much. I'm just an individual observer, but this is what I've seen. And I know on the other side of the coin, Charles Koch from Koch Brothers, he's kind of really hardcore into that type of mindset as well. Make your people feel empowered and give them authority in that way. But I think to Dr. Tomas's point, obviously we have definitely come a long way, but I do think Great Resignation is also going to be a contributor to help companies to become more people-centric, because people have more options now. Like, they don't have to stick around and deal with the toxic leader anymore. I can be working in California tomorrow, even though I'm here in New York. So I'm hoping that helps push it along a little bit. But yeah, I agree. I mean, baby steps. But if I had a magic wand, that would be what I would do. But unfortunately, I can't. So I have to drag in all of my friends with fancy titles to try and help me get the message across.
Yeah. Well, it's always good to have friends with fancy titles. But I think there might be some toxic leaders in California as well. I don't have data, but I think that potentially there could be one or two.
Maybe, give or take.
Lisa, I was thinking the same thing about the Great Resignation and the fact that the balance of power seems to be shifting a bit more towards employees. And we're seeing things like unions having a resurgence at the jeopardy of opening a whole nother can of worms. Sure, we could have like multiple episodes on that whole idea, but it is very interesting. And I think organizations are going to need to start thinking about how do we preemptively deal with this so people don't unionize and so that we can retain employees. Because I think, Dr. Tomas, you talked about this earlier. I thought it was fascinating that it costs 2.5 times more to retain a toxic leader than it does to recruit a superstar that actually could be a catalyst for greater productivity and profitability within organizations. So, well, with that, I think that we should start wrapping up. Dr. Amy, I'd love for you to give us a last word of wisdom or your thoughts on what we've discussed today.
Oh, we've covered so much territory and wisdom is in short supply, but I think it's really important that you're teaming up to shed some light on these issues and inviting those of us who gather data about it to have this conversation. So thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. This was really an honor and a privilege to talk to you, and learned quite a lot. Dr. Tomas, what do you have to share with us?
Yeah, I think leadership matters. And I think we've been reminded in a hard way during these last 2 years of the importance of having the right people in charge and the consequences of not. So I think well done on putting this out there and spreading the word. And I think we cannot stop because more progress needs to happen. And I think the world will be a lot better off if we have better people in charge. And we have the evidence, but the evidence is never enough. You also need to persuade in all possible ways, emotionally, and drill down the message and make people part of this quest, of this battle, I think. And so delighted to have spent a little bit of time with you on this today.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And hopefully this podcast will be maybe one little push in that direction to help persuade senior leaders that they need to pay more attention to this. So Lisa, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you. I just can't express how happy I am that these folks have been kind enough to join us on this journey. And I know they've been fighting this battle for years. I'm new to this field, this battle, but I'm just bringing awareness to it again. I don't know how to reach all of the right people. It's definitely a big problem to solve. But like you were saying earlier, if we can just in any way move the needle just a little bit further, then that's better than what we had last year. So thank you guys all so much for your time. I've just been so thrilled with the feedback and I can't wait to see these podcasts hopefully take off and go viral.
Okay, well, thanks to all of you. And that's a wrap for Winning the Game at Work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Winning the Game at Work. If you enjoyed what you heard, please like, share, and subscribe. If you'd like to get in touch, go to the show notes. I'd love to hear from you. And now get out there and start winning the game of work. I'm cheering you on.